Welcome to Lubetkin's Other Blog Podcast. This is podcast number 17 for Thursday, February 16th. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host. Hurricane Katrina rocked the nation like no other natural disaster in history, and impaired communications became one of the many challenges in the midst of that chaos. Today at the Philadelphia chapter of the Public Relations Society of America, we hosted a panel of communicators who experienced the Hurricane Katrina situation firsthand, both as on-site helpers in the aftermath and as documentary producers and reporters on the actions taken by the rescue workers. The program took place in Cherry Hill as a breakfast program, and introducing the panel was the president of the Philadelphia chapter, Michelle Cherisi, APR, who is senior internal communications consultant for Aramark Corporation. And before we get into the panel, I'd just like to mention that last week I had the opportunity to have dinner with Shel Holtz, the co-host of the For Immediate Release podcast. Shel and Neville and I have corresponded on numerous occasions and exchanged audio, and of course Shel and Neville have been interviewed for some of my other podcasting endeavors. We had a very nice dinner, and in the course of the dinner, had an opportunity to play a game that many people play called Jewish Geography, Who Do You Know, Where Do You Go, and discovered that we have some folks in common. I had started listening to Shel's wife's podcasts. Michelle Holtz is the host of Your Jewish Neighborhood, which is a podcast produced on behalf of Temple Isaiah in Lafayette, California. And I also know the cantor, who is one of the members of the clergy at that congregation, a fellow by the name of Lee Korn, who I had the great privilege to meet and study with and learn from during an adult learning experience at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati two summers ago. And so it was a great pleasure to know that that connection is still there, and we appreciate Shel taking good wishes back home with him. And while he was here in Philadelphia, Shel had me record a call-out, which are the promos that people do for each other's podcasts. Hi, this is so-and-so. You're listening to so-and-so's podcast, that sort of thing. Back in the radio days, we called them promos. Not quite a public service announcement. It's more of a station promo or a program promo. And actually what we'll do is throw in an example of one that was recorded for the college radio station that I worked for. Since we're in the Olympic time period, it's probably appropriate to bring this one in. One of the gold medal U.S. women swimmers back in the 70s was a classmate of mine, a student at Monmouth College. Her name was Wendy Bolio, and she recorded this promo for us at that time.
Hi, this is Wendy Bolio. This year, the WMCX sports staff will be bringing you excellent coverage of Monmouth College sports. Keep listening to 88.1 FM for details on the next WMCX sports presentation. Now, if they had only been covering the Olympics.
Let's get into the program for today. Just so you know, the panelists did show some multimedia presentations, which are obviously not part of this podcast, and for simplicity's sake, we've simply edited out the audio. A couple of them, we might have faced some licensing issues because they were a video from broadcast news outlets, and also some issues with copyright clearance on some audio recordings of music that may or may not be permitted to be used in a podcast. So we took those out. It doesn't detract significantly from the presentation or the remarks by the panelists, and we hope you enjoy it. We'll be back on the other side.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you for coming. Welcome to the New Jersey contingent. Woohoo! All right. Having grown up here and started my career here, it's great to be in New Jersey. One of the things that we're doing this year, first let me introduce myself. I'm Michelle Cherisi from Aramark, and I'm your president of the Philadelphia chapter this year. So welcome to the meeting, and welcome to 2006. This is our second program of the year. And one of the things that we're trying to do in listening to the perspectives of the membership that we did from our survey last fall is to spread out the meetings in different places in the Delaware Valley, South Jersey, Conshohocken, Montgomery County, all different places that folks have said that they want us to meet at different times of day. So these are all experiments, but we're hopeful that this pans out. So we're trying to meet everybody's needs. So thank you for being a part of this. We have a really timely topic today that everybody has been touched by, some of us in the room more than others, but we're really excited to have an esteemed group of panelists as well as a special guest who we'll introduce in a minute to talk about Hurricane Katrina and her aftermath. But before we start, just a couple of announcements. Our February meeting is here, obviously. We have something that we're trying new this year as well is we're sponsoring teleseminars, and the teleseminars that you all get the notices for from PRSA National, normally you would pay $190 and you would get a license, and then you would be able to listen to this from your desk or with others in your conference room at your places of business. What the chapter is doing is buying licenses for a few select seminars that we think are of particular interest to the membership and then sponsoring those at one place, so you can attend the seminar for $25 a person as opposed to $190. So I encourage all of you to take a look at the website. There are three upcoming. There's one upcoming at the end of February, and then there's one March 1st, and there's a two-parter March 1st and 8th, and that one's particularly interesting because it's about issues with the Latin community. I think it's pretty timely in terms of diversity and a lot of the things that are touching people in their everyday lives. So please take a look at the website and see if any of those topics interest you. And again, it's a really good deal for you and for your organization. Then on March 15th, we have a doubleheader. Late in the afternoon, there's going to be an event that's really going to be about PRSA and what your membership value brings you. It's kind of geared toward new members, but if you've been around for a while and you've never become involved, or you don't know how to become involved, you don't know what the opportunities are out there, this is a great program for you to attend. And then it's followed by, nicely enough, a sponsored happy hour from Levlane. So that's going to be held at the Lowe's in Center City, and then the happy hour will be at Soul Food, which is just downstairs at Lowe's. So for those of you who can make that, that would be great. And then lastly, in March, we have on March 24th at the Valley Forge, I believe it's the Valley Forge Hilton, it's our first joint meeting with another organization for the year, and that's being held jointly with the International Association of Online Communicators, and it's actually their convention, but the speaker is Shel Holtz. For those of you who are into online communication, he's world-renowned, essentially, and he's going to be the keynote speaker. So it's a luncheon out in Valley Forge. So, again, trying to spread out the geography and the timing and all those things, so we're hopeful we can meet everybody's needs. So what we're going to do today is we have our panel, and each of the organizations is going to take 10 minutes to talk about their involvement with Hurricane Katrina and how they were touched, and then we're going to field questions. But before we start, I do want to introduce one special guest. Joe, if you could stand. This is Joe White. Joe is a Rowan grad. Joe and his wife actually went through the hurricane, and I don't want to say lost a lot of your valuables. Well, you can say that, but okay. So Joe is here. Joe is, again, a Rowan grad. He's a local guy. He's living in Pittman, and he and his wife are back in the area with their new baby, who is 3 months old, and we're delighted to have him here. And you might want to just say hello to Joe afterwards and introduce yourself and welcome him back to the area. He's also seeking a job. So if anybody has any positions that you think would be appropriate for a former media relations guy for University of New Orleans or any other PR function, which he's done a great deal of, that would be great. Okay? So welcome, Joe. Welcome home. Okay. We'll introduce the panel real quickly, and then we're going to start with Steve Rosen, and then we'll go from there. Steve is the president of Star Rosen PR, which is the PR division of the Star Group. And Steve and his team were involved intimately with the Touro Infirmary, which is one of New Orleans' oldest hospitals, and they did a multifaceted media blitz, if you will, I guess we'll call it internal blitz, and in terms of helping to manage information for that organization. So I'm not going to steal Steve's thunder and talk any more about that. And then next, we have a tag team from Aramark. I'm always proud to work for Aramark, but these are the days when I'm especially proud to work for Aramark because my coworkers have really done instrumental things in terms of this event. Owen Edmonston, who's the Senior Director of Internal Communications, and Dave Freirich, who is the Manager of PR on the external side, both were on site at the Houston Astrodome and can talk about the many places that Aramark offered facility and food services to the victims of the hurricane. And then lastly, we have Jeff Brody. Jeff is the president of Omni Video Creations, and Jeff has a long line of experience with NFL films and video production, correct? And Jeff was instrumental in putting together a documentary about how the hurricane affected the Jewish community in New Orleans. So we are just thrilled to have all three of them. So we're going to start with Steve Rosen and go from there.
Hello, good morning. We had a really, a lot of us had a very interesting Labor Day. We had a client in the New Jersey area, a gentleman named Les Hirsch, who had the interesting luck to, a week before Hurricane Katrina, move down to New Orleans to become the head of a hospital called Touro Infirmary. Touro, it's actually a Jewish hospital, but like so many hospitals over time, it basically became a community hospital, known as the hospital where people have babies, very much a part of the community. If you're familiar with New Orleans, it was in the Garden District, which is a beautiful, beautiful part of New Orleans. And we got a call, or actually the head of our company got a call, because she was a friend of his, and he said, I've just come down to New Orleans, like a few days before Katrina. He said, I'd like your advice. I'm a bit, obviously concerned about this hurricane. And the biggest issue is, will we survive this hurricane? So literally, many of us, our Labor Day weekend was caught up in, how could we help Les get through the storm? What could we do for him, et cetera, et cetera? And our work literally started before the storm, where we were actually connecting him up with news media to basically be a commentator, sort of on the ground, talking about the issues. But very quickly, our work became far more important. The storm came, and essentially we lost contact with Les. The only way we could communicate was for a little while on a cell phone, and then there was like one landline that seemed to work. So our job very interestingly and quickly morphed. So it started out a little bit about getting him some press, communications, helping, making him kind of be the eyes and the ears and the voice to the world about what was going in New Orleans, to his hospital really being under siege. So what we did first, which was really fascinating, was he got through the storm, and as I said, we were able to communicate with him. He stayed at the hospital. But one of the things was all the communications essentially shut down in New Orleans. So we actually, up here in New Jersey, set up phone lines so that he and his management team and other people he wanted to communicate with could actually communicate. The next thing we did, within days, we created a website. And I never appreciated so much the power of the internet or how wonderful it was, because essentially after the storm, some of the people at the hospital had kind of like battened down the hatches and were there on site, but most of the people were kind of flung to the winds. And the hospital very quickly needed to, they wanted to relocate employees. A lot of the patients were evacuated, and they wanted to try to find patients. Families were very upset, and the website we created literally became the communications channel. It was built so that people could get emergency information. It was built so that if you were an employee, you could connect with Touro. It was built so if you were a family member trying to find someone who had been in Touro, you could use this as a means of access. The other thing we did, since they couldn't really set up a phone system down there, at our agency, 30 of us literally became the Touro emergency hotline. And we were getting, hundreds of calls a day, but essentially all calls were routed through the agency, and we were almost sort of like their external staff for a bit. As I'm sure you're not surprised, we got tons and tons of press, and it was very interesting as a PR person, who very often our job is to try to make stories that aren't so interesting newsworthy. Of course, in a situation like this, there was tons of news interest, and our whole job was managing that news interest. But as I said in the beginning, our goal from the start was helping Touro survive through the storm, because as you've read, I'm sure, many hospitals and institutions will not reopen, and our whole goal was to make Touro viable for the future. As horrific as that was to, once we got past the storm, try to help Touro come back to life and stay viable. So we started obviously, we were the first emergency room to open in New Orleans. So we started with, you know, many communications, one of which was, you know, an ad campaign just letting people in New Orleans know that the ER was open again. And we also staged meetings for physicians and employees, because one of the big challenges was, particularly right after the storm, actually getting people to work at Touro. And so we had a series of, actually it was amazing, by remote control we set up a series of meetings that were very effective in that regard. That's an example of a billboard just letting people know that the hospital is open. Then we came out with the concept of bringing New Orleans back to health, because we felt, as horrific as the hurricane was, we couldn't wallow in that. If we were to move forward and the hospital was to move forward, we really needed to come out with a hopeful message. So we started a campaign, which still continues, called Bringing New Orleans Back to Health. We had an opening ceremony in our ER. And probably last but not least, as many of you know, recruiting nurses around the country is challenging. Try recruiting nurses in New Orleans. So we actually started a whole advertising campaign and a series of meetings aimed at getting nurses. And one of the things we're very proud of, after our first campaign and our first series of meetings, we actually were able to help Touro hire 70 nurses, which I think is tough enough to do in any area, let alone in New Orleans. So the work continues. It's still very challenging, but the silver lining is that we really believe Touro is going to survive and thrive and maybe actually be a stronger hospital than it was before the storm.
Okay, great, Steve. Thanks. And Steve, just as an aside, not that this is integral to the New Orleans story, but Les Hirsch is a local guy, right?
Yes, he was actually the CEO of Cooper before he moved to Arizona, and then he went to Touro.
Okay, great. Thanks, Steve. All right. Owen and Dave?
For those of you who don't know, Aramark provides food and facility services to multiple institutions across the country, stadiums, arenas, healthcare facilities, businesses, and industries. And we're going to start off by showing you just a couple photos from our experience down in Houston. This is the Astrodome shortly after evacuees started arriving in Houston from New Orleans and Mississippi. It's obviously a serving line at one of the convention centers down at Reliant Park, and obviously housekeeping and cleaning services on the floor of the Houston Astrodome. All of you have probably are all too familiar with a lot of these photos that appeared on the newscasts in the days and weeks, and even today following the storm. At the height of the storm, Aramark helped provide services to evacuees, like I said, at multiple locations across the country, most notably Houston's Reliant Park, which also includes the Houston Astrodome, which is probably the most famous or most recognizable of all the locations where the evacuees were relocated. The way Aramark got involved was that Aramark already has the contract for the food and facility services at Houston's Reliant Park, which, like I said, includes the Astrodome. So it was natural for FEMA and Red Cross to contact us almost as one of the first service organizations to help provide the services when it was known that evacuees from New Orleans and Mississippi were going to be bused to Houston for housing. When we did finally find out, our GM jumped in without asking any questions and just said, "What do you need and how can we help?" Everything else would take care of itself later. At the height of the relief efforts in Houston, we were providing 110,000 meals a day to approximately 26,000 evacuees. So it was a pretty big undertaking, but having worked at some of the world's largest events, we were more than prepared to provide our services for this. So that's just a little bit of background about what we did on the ground in Houston. Now I'll kind of transition to what our communications plan was in order to kind of respond to and help those folks out on the ground. When we found out the storm was approaching and that it was going to be a really big storm, we immediately assembled a crisis team, which consisted of external communications, internal communications, our government affairs team, as well as our community relations team. And we all got together on a regular basis to kind of see What services do we provide in the affected areas, the areas that were in the eye of the storm, and what scenarios would involve our involvement, or where would we need to interact and become involved? Once we realized the magnitude of the storm and once the levees broke, we created an integrated communications plan, which involved representatives from all of those communication lines, and like I said, held daily conference calls, daily meetings, and put together this plan. By nature, Aramark is not a boastful company, so our primary goal was to provide timely, accurate, and meaningful information, obviously in a very respectful manner. At the outset, most of what we were doing was on a reactive nature, responding to inquiries from national outlets as well as local outlets in the Gulf Coast region and Houston. The Friday of Labor Day weekend is when we made the decision to send a representative down to Houston to provide on-site representation and on-site support to our team down there and help respond, like I said, in a more timely and effective manner to those responses those inquiries that we were receiving. And the team back in Philadelphia helped create fact sheets, talking points, and other materials that we could use to respond to national inquiries on a pretty quick and immediate basis. I, as Michelle alluded to, was the designated representative to go down to Houston. Really picked up my thing, got a call Friday morning while I was back visiting my family, which for what I thought was going to be the start of a nice weekend. Immediately turned around, came back, hopped on a flight, arrived in Houston. Literally had no idea what I was really going to be doing while I was down on the ground, and just kind of, you know, navigated and found my way throughout the Houston Reliant Park complex, making contact with the Media Relations Center, the Red Cross spokesperson, media representatives on the ground, and obviously remaining in constant and close contact with our general managers down on the team in order to provide quick and effective updates to the media that was there. Now, we talk about some of the challenges that we faced. At the very beginning, when we started receiving evacuees to the Houston's Reliant Park, we started receiving emails from citizens saying that they heard rumors that we were charging the evacuees for the food. So obviously, we had to jump into crisis mode immediately and respond to all of those rumors and emails and let them know that, in fact, that was not the case. So not only did we respond to each individual email that we received from the public, we also made a point of reaching out to the media and getting those messages and communications put out on websites as quickly as possible. And again, another challenge was remaining respectful of the situation down at Houston. We didn't want to appear to be taking advantage of other people's misfortune in order to further our name and the services that we provide. So what we basically did was we kind of assessed the situation, and once things stabilized, that following Tuesday and Wednesday is when we started to do a little bit more of a proactive campaign. And the results were very favorable. Kind of highlighting what it was we were providing, not only in Houston, but also across the country. Received coverage in USA Today, New York Times, multiple stories in Houston's regional publications as well. So I think what we put together was very effective. Like I said, you know, the situation changed daily, so we kind of had to just go with the flow from an external standpoint. Now, like I said, that was one part of an overall integrated program. And Owen can talk a little bit more about what we did on an internal standpoint while connecting with the employees of Aramark.
Okay. On the internal side, we focus a lot at Aramark on employee engagement, which is that emotional commitment that people make to their job, which is seen as a primary driver of the effort that people put into their job, the ability of a team to form, all that kind of stuff. And the key is to communicate to people, to make sure people understand who we are as a company, what is it we're trying to achieve, what does it mean to be part of this organization. And at Aramark, we talk a lot about creating partnerships with our clients, helping our clients achieve their missions, kind of being in the background and focusing on what their goals are, and also being part of our communities and being in every phase and every part of life within the community. And often when tragedy strikes, because we're a global company, we're often somehow affected by it and somehow in a position where we can help. So as this tragedy unfolded, you know, people were watching it on TV, they were seeing it on the web, all across the country, and, you know, many of us were looking at it saying, geez, I wish I could do something about this. I wish, you know, I could, I'm sitting up here in Spokane, Washington, but I wish I could help these people. And one of the key messages we wanted to get out to the people at Aramark is just by the nature of the fact that you work at Aramark, just do your job because you are helping these people. Because we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of employees on the ground who are helping to feed these people and are making sure that the facility, the air conditioning works in the shelter and all the different activities that we were doing for them. So what we were trying to do with our internal communication then was capture the magnitude of what we were doing and convey to our own people that sense of pride and sense of commitment in the support that we were offering. So the way we did that was we had a daily e-newsletter going out. We put writers on the ground in Houston, and we also had people, of course, in Philadelphia. We sent somebody down to Washington. Aramark was actually involved in, I think, 22 different locations around the country supporting evacuees, you know, all over the place. Because, as Dave said, we're the nature of our business is that, you know, in the middle of a crisis, the most important things are how do you get people fed, how about shelter, how about clothing, and this is all, that's all stuff that we do every day. We know how to do that. We have a lot of resources, so we're often able to help. So we took, with the writers we had on the ground, we also had video crews down in Houston, we had a photographer down in Houston, but with the daily e-newsletters, we took a blog approach where every day the writer who was there would just, at 3 o'clock, would file whatever they had. And it would range from some full-length stories, just some quotes, some personal observations, and then we just push it out to the whole company via our email system, and we could reach about 25,000 people. We found it to be very effective. I was down in Houston for 3 days myself. It was one of the most fascinating experiences of my career, because often, at least on the internal side, often when you go in to do a story, everything's planned out ahead of time. You know you're going to interview this person at 10 o'clock, you're going to shoot these photos at 3 p.m. And this, as Dave was alluding to on the external side, you know, I just landed in Houston and went to the Astrodome and started talking to people knowing I had to file something at 3 o'clock. I had the advantage that the person who had been in there ahead of me had kind of laid the groundwork of what are we doing, all the practical details, so I could kind of look for more interesting human stories. But it was a very, very interesting, very challenging opportunity. The response we got from our employees to the whole effort was just overwhelming. We got just dozens and dozens of emails back from people, and I'll just share a couple of quotes from you. As I sit at my desk and read this issue, my heart fills with pride. I couldn't work for a more amazing company. It was one person. Although I'm not near one of the areas to offer my services, I feel honor and pride that I work for such a wonderful company, which continues to show that it can be counted on at any given moment, which was exactly what we were trying to convey to people, that kind of going back to the employee engagement thing, that, you know, if you're sitting up in Spokane, the way you can help the refugees is by processing those expense reports that you do every day, because as a company, you're part of a team that is helping the people.
That's great. That's great stuff. Thanks, Owen and Dave. Jeff?
First of all, it's funny you look at this picture, and our first reaction was Wizard of Oz. That's a house on top of a car.
Oh, my gosh.
Down in the lower Ninth Ward, and I'll talk about where that came from. The reality of this, by the way, is that when I was down there, I bumped into a National Geographic photographer named Dave Burnett, who was doing a story that will be out the end of August. And we were talking, and he just said to me in 2 seconds, look over there, snapped it and went away. You look at a picture like that, now you know why he works for National Geographic. He did it so quick. And then he emailed it to me a month ago and gave me permission to use it. So some quick background. I was the first intern that NFL Films had back in 1979, 1980, and it turned into a career. My studio has been in my house for the last 25 years, so... And this is our 25th year, so that's why all of you, I see all these suits here. I don't think I own a suit, and most of my work gets done in pajamas. And what happened here is that somehow I went from doing NFL football. When I left there, I was doing college sports, seemed to be the natural flow. But then one day they came out with Title IX, And Title IX meant for me that all the football highlights, all those major colleges I was doing, now told me that you also had to show equal amounts of women's sports and men's sports. But it went further than that. It was equal amounts of fencing and golf. And to me, my client said, you know what, we're just not going to do films anymore. So literally one day I had to reinvent myself. And through a suggestion actually from my sister, who's an executive with Frito-Lay, she an advertising executive for that matter, she basically told me that for the next year she wanted me to do nothing but nonprofit work. And that was 20 years ago. And her theory was that if I took what I learned at NFL Films, the slow motion, the tight images, the emotional angle of it, and used it for other purposes, that people would catch on. So I started doing work for Special Olympics, and in fact rented an office next door to Special Olympics. That really keyed the rest of my career. I've done their work now for 18 years now, but what happened is that I basically do or don't do what I learned or didn't learn at NFL Films. I shoot the way they taught me. I write the way they taught me. It even gets narrated by some of the same voices. So the end result is that today, most of my work is for nonprofits. Most of my work has an emotional tinge to it, whether it's public awareness or fundraising, marketing, whatever. The heart and soul of it is usually emotional. So that's why when I'm telling Special Olympic stories, whatever. Through the years, I did a lot of work for Jewish organizations for their public awareness, and that led into now about 85% of my business is Jewish organizations. This past November, I got a phone call from one of the largest ones, which is URJ, the Reunion for Reform Judaism. They have a convention in Houston with over 6,000 people there. And you walk into this venue, and there's six 30-foot screens in this incredible multimedia event. And they wanted me to produce a film, a documentary about what happened in Katrina, but how the synagogues were affected. And I did that without going down there. They weren't going to pay for me to go down. They had a certain budget. We had to do five films, so we couldn't put it all into one. So we got stills. We got a lot of dramatic images. We stole some from the TV shows, whatever. We found what we could find, and we put together a film that affected a lot of people. And people were very emotionally affected. And that was about the synagogues. The next thing I know is I got a phone call from the people that run all the Jewish community centers nationwide. They happened to be there. They wanted to send me there and do a full piece on how the Jewish community in general was affected and how the JCC membership was affected. We're doing that now, and that's what I went down to shoot. Now, what I did was I took footage from that, and I actually produced a piece, a little music video that I did for you to just give you a sense. It may end up being in the film, but we threw it together yesterday. But from that, we got a call again from someone else the other day from Jewish Family Service down there. Those are the people that provide services to seniors and to young children, Meals on Wheels, that type of thing. And there, I'm going back next week to do a piece for them. So they domino these things, but it's the same but different, and they all are sharing each other's footage and stories. So people allowed me to go into their homes. They walked me through the remnants of their homes. We actually went down to the Lower Ninth because that seemed to be the one place, if you're going to go shoot visuals, that you have to get that CNN visual of the hole in the roof and all that. And while we were walking through the rubble of someone's home, the owner of the home walked up behind us. And I got to tell you, our heart sank. You know, I'm not a news guy. I'm not a guy that's going to just get the shot no matter what. And he walked up with his mother. And the mom said, keep shooting. We need people to know we're not okay. And they also took it further. This was in the same week that the Willy Wonka line came out. The T-shirts were everywhere of the mayor being depicted as Willy Wonka because he said the line about being a chocolate town. And the jokes were everywhere. As bad as it was with Leno and Letterman last night with the vice president, you should have heard the Wonka lines down there. And this woman said, people are now not taking us seriously anymore, and people are actually thinking of holding a Mardi Gras. She goes, as soon as people see them throwing beads, some people outside of New Orleans are going to think we're okay, and we're not. I want you to keep shooting. And we're going through their home, and she says, there's my Bible. And there's a shot of her Bible there. So it was very emotional. From the moment we hit the ground, the first line, two things came to mind. Wizard of Oz. You're going to see in the images, lots of cars on cars. We saw trees on roofs, but then we have images of roofs that are up in trees. I never saw anything like it. Then we had the barge that came down in the Lower Ninth, landed on a school bus. That image is actually in here. You'll see that. It was, and we did do some news-type shooting, which meant we didn't have permission to go certain places, but we just plowed through anyway. You know, we saw the security guy coming, but I was able to shoot the shot of them busting up the levee before they could get to me, and they didn't take the film, so that's in here. But the bottom line was, and the other thing that came to mind when I first saw the Lower Ninth was Hiroshima. I mean, it looked like that. Mm-hmm. And for miles and miles, and I keep looking at you for a reaction, for miles and miles, and you can see when you go over the bridge, the change. Like you go through, you know, you're uptown, and you see people boarded up, and you see signs. There's one great sign on a shop, a rug store on Charles Avenue, where it's painted on the outside, "Don't dare, I'm inside with an ugly woman and a hungry dog and a hammer," I think is what it's on, and a shotgun and a hammer. It says, and all these signs are everywhere. That, but then as you drive away from uptown, you can see it deteriorate as you get further toward the different levees that broke, and when you get down to the Lower Ninth, it's an incredibly overwhelming sight. So the end result is that what I'm doing now is for public awareness. It is for fundraising. And at the heart of it, by the way, there's one other quick story to this, and I'll show the video. When I landed, on my way to the airport, there was a report on the news here that a group of students from St. Joe's had gone down there, and on New Year's Day, they didn't celebrate New Year's. Instead, they flew down and just basically went door to door looking for where they could help. That group was posing for pictures because my son is a student at St. Joe's. And I see the St. Joe shirts, and they're posing at the airport. So they told me at the airport that they were putting together a TV documentary, but they just shot film. They had no idea how to put it together. So yesterday, that group of students came to our studio, and we're going to produce that piece with them. They're going to do the editing, the writing, and everything. I just kind of gave them some guidance. And that piece will be out on March 16th. So I'm not quite sure what they're going to come out with.
This was actually where Jeff showed the short video.
That's amazing. People never lose their senses of humor, though. I'm up here getting sobby, and then I see the Three Stooges T-shirt. Just kind of brings it all home. Thanks, gentlemen. That's terrific video, Jeff. That's great work. And thanks to all four of you. Those are just amazing stories. Does anybody have questions for the gentleman before we wrap it up? I have a question. I'll start it off. Dave talked about being respectful when covering the events of the hurricane and interacting with people. And for any or all of you, did you meet with a lot of resistance? I mean, were there people that just didn't want their stories told? Jeff talked about the fact that people really did, but I mean, did you run into people who didn't? Steve, I don't know.
Well, I mean, our perspective was kind of different because it was so much about hospitals and health cares, and you know, our objective was to get a lot of attention and not in a commercial or marketing type way. Our thought was the more attention we could get for Touro, the stronger chance of it surviving and being around. So our perspective was a little different than
sure.
asking people to tell their, you know, tough, tragic stories,
right.
which there were so many.
Right. Anybody else?
Well, I guess my job was to get the tough, tragic stories. I found the only resistance that I got was not from the homeowners themselves. They seemed to find some relief in talking to somebody and telling their story. And from my perspective, they knew that it was going to go out and people would hear it. The only resistance we got was from security people. Like, we were shooting in a FEMA disaster center. Mm-hmm. The JCC there has been turned into a FEMA disaster center. And the people in line and everything were more than willing to talk about their story. It was the security people there that were dragging us out, saying you can't be here, and mm-hmm. with that. But the people themselves were very willing to talk. Mm-hmm. That woman in there was outside her home, and she came up to us and said, would you talk to me?
Mm.
So,
yeah, one interesting just side note, I mean, in the Paul Azan story where they're talking about evacuating people from the roof, what we actually had to do with Les's encouragement was call major media and try to get them to fly over and do stories, because he was having trouble evacuating, and he talked about the challenges of getting helicopters and airlifts and things like that. So one of the things, talk about an interesting thing, he was like, you know, you've got to get some national media outlet to fly over so that they see there are people on the roof here, which is kind of wild.
That is wild.
If I can mention one thing, at the end of the whole thing, the one ultimate moral to the story that we came away with was the unique dynamic that at the end of the day, there is this huge lower-income African-American community there that can't afford to come back, and many have nothing to come back to. Then we were there documenting a middle- and upper-class Jewish white community who can afford to choose not to come back. At the end of the day, none of them are coming back. And that was what we found. There is people there that are talking about the fact that in their hearts, they're born and raised in New Orleans, and they talk about this unique thing about living in New Orleans. They want to be there. But they said that spend the next decade of them and their children's relationship fighting to build it back. Their children will be grown and gone, and they're going to spend all that time. They don't want to spend all those years fighting. That's what we found in the community that we spoke to. They want to stay. In their hearts and souls, they want to stay, but they don't want to spend the next decade of their family relationship fighting to come back. And then at the end of the day, they all talk about, and what if we build it back and the levees break again? That comes in at the end of every interview, that's what comes up. What if it happens again?
I just want to add something to that, too. When I was in Houston, the second day, I went down on the floor of the Astrodome to talk to some of the evacuees. And the reaction that I got was actually, it ran the whole gamut. There were some people, actually I would say most of the people, were very willing to talk. They were obviously very angry about what had happened to them in New Orleans. And the main thing they wanted to talk about was their anger about that. The main thing I was obviously looking for them to talk about was their experience there in Houston. But they were also very, very thankful for how well things were going in Houston. And then there were other folks that saw me walk up with my notebook and, you know, dressed as not in a suit, obviously, but dressed, obviously I was not an evacuee, who saw me more as like an official person and didn't want to have anything to do with me. It was very, very interesting. It was kind of uncomfortable, you know, going up to people. But I heard some really amazing stories.
It's great.
If I could add one other thing, I would say, adding on to what Owen said, that unless you were escorted by a member of the media center in Houston, you technically weren't allowed to go onto the floor of the Astrodome. But news people being the way they are, investigative, you know, trying to get the story and not have the story controlled for you, you know, oftentimes you would see them walking around on the floor of the Astrodome or walking through the complex unescorted, trying to get that story that, you know, maybe the folks who were FEMA, who was overseeing the relief efforts there, really didn't want you to hear, or the shots that they didn't really want you to see. So it was kind of interesting to see, you know, the control mechanisms that FEMA is trying to institute in Houston.
That was by direction of FEMA, that people were not allowed on the floor unescorted?
That's correct.
Okay.
And they kept changing the IDs.
Exactly.
Every day there was like a different ID that we had to get to be able to move around.
So. I mean, it seemed like daily they were instituting and implementing different processes for allowing you access to different areas. And eventually by the end, I mean, it was very regulated as to where you could go.
I think one of the things that I noticed there that actually the first day kind of embarrassed me a bit. On the first day there, they said that one of the local community members volunteered to take me around the Lower Ninth and drive me around. And a beautiful Lexus SUV pulls up with all these family members in there, children, whatever. And I get in the car, and when we drive through, what you have is a handful of people whose houses are totally destroyed in the Lower Ninth. I mean, there's nothing left there. But they have nothing to go home to, so they're up on the roof patching the hole that they were pulled through. The rest of the house is destroyed, but this is all they have. So they're patching the roof. And this is a neighborhood that the people there will tell us, the white people don't go down to the Lower Ninth and drive around the Lower Ninth. But what you look around now, it's a tourist attraction. We're sitting there in a Lexus, ours lily white car in our Lexus, driving around with our cameras, taking pictures. And it felt weird. It felt wrong. And we looked around, and that's all you saw was carloads of people, with lots of people in those cars driving around taking little snapshots with their digital cameras out the window. And here were these people trying to fix their lives. That's sort of what it became when we were there, and that became one of the things that we wrote about.
Are there other questions? Marilyn.
Yeah, I just left the Mexico City job as the VP of the Chamber of Commerce right before Katrina hit to go into the cruise industry, which obviously is, an interesting area to be in when hurricanes hit. And one of the things that happened was that because Katrina hit New Orleans lost its ports, Carnival came in and brought in two ships, Relation and Holiday, and which should have been really good PR and a really good thing to happen. However, from a PR standpoint, it actually got backfired at Carnival, and I can't tell you all the details of what happened and the perception of the media, but it was a FEMA issue. FEMA was paying them more than it would normally cost a normal individual to be on the ship. But what could have been a really great PR story for Carnival and a really good interest, human interest for the people of New Orleans kind of turned around and became a negative story. Mm. And I just thought I'd bring that up because there's a lot of great things happening. Aramark, the story you guys told, it was done right, it was done appropriately, it was presented, and it was communicated effectively. However, you can see if it's not done effectively communicated, yeah, you can turn around. And at being in the cruise industry, I get people asking me about that all the time. Those ships are finally going to be no longer in New Orleans, probably in another month or two, but the port of New Orleans won't even be open until October of 2000. Mm.
Right. Yes, ma'am.
In terms of Aramark, can you talk a little bit about what the experience was like with various government agencies and how that helped our user?
Yeah, I wasn't too involved. We had another individual handling the government relations side, but what they were involved with was communicating with, you know, the different government representatives, letting them know what we're doing, how we're involved. You know, obviously dealing with the Red Cross at a much higher level than what I was dealing with them at. But they made it a point of sending letters to the various congressmen, just informing them, keeping them apprised of all the food services and facility services and housing and shelter services that we were providing, not just in Houston, but all across the country, kind of to make sure everything was kind of running in sync with one another, on that level.
Mm-hmm. Owen, did you have any experience with that or no?
I really didn't. I mean, I had a conversation with the head of the Red Cross in Houston, and he simply commented on the fact that, you know, it was usually in this type of situation, a smaller crisis, the Red Cross handles feeding people and sheltering people, but this was so big and so overwhelming that he appreciated the fact that Aramark was already in there managing the building, doing the food, and our willingness to work with him to meet this crisis.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you all. This was really informative. I thought it was great. I think they all did a great job. Round of applause. And thank you all for coming. Again, please check the website for the March programs. And again, welcome Joe back to the community. Thanks. Have a great day.
And that will wrap things up for another podcast here at Lubetkin's Other Blog Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the program. And we do invite your comments and suggestions about these programs. If you have some thoughts you want to share with us, we welcome your emails at Steve, STEVE, at Lubetkin, LUBETKIN, .net. And you can also send us audio files. We'll take audio comments if you like, and we'll use them in a future program. So thanks for listening, and be sure to also visit our Lubetkin's Other blog at blogspot.com and take part in our listener survey. We're doing a listener survey with podtrack.com, which is a new service for tracking the listenership of podcast programs. It will help us understand who our audiences are. You can also visit lubetkin.net, that's www.lubetkin.net, and we have links on our website to the surveys for each of our different podcasts. As you may know, we produce podcasts for several different topic areas, and they are all linked there with their own very unique and very special surveys. Our theme music comes from the Internet Audio Guy at www.internetaudioguy.com. Mike Stewart, who provides all sorts of packages for podcasters and downloadable music beds that you can use and some other ones that you can buy. And we appreciate him making those available to us. So thanks again for listening. From all of us here at Lubetkin's Other Blog, this is Steve Lubetkin saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.